The lot fell to the children of Joseph from the Jordan, by Jericho, to the waters of Jericho on the east, to the wilderness that goes up from Jericho through the mountains to Bethel, then went out from Bethel to Luz, passed along to the border of the Archites at Ataroth, and went down westward to the boundary of the Japhletites, as far as the boundary of lower Beth Horon to Gaza, and it ended at the sea. So the children of Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim took their inheritance. The border of the children of Ephraim, according to their families, was thus. The border of their inheritance on the east side was Ataroth Edah, as far as upper Beth Horon, and the border went up toward the sea on the north side of Mikmethath. Then the border went around eastward to Tanath Shiloh, and passed by it on the east of Janohath. Then it went down from Janohath to Ataroth and Narath, and reached to Jericho, and came out at the Jordan. The border went out from Tapuah westward to the brook Cana, and it ended at the sea. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Ephraim, according to their families. The separate cities for the children of Ephraim were among the inheritance of the children of Manasseh, all the cities with their villages. And they did not drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gaza, but the Canaanites dwell among the Ephraimites to this day and have become forced laborers. And chapter 17. There was also a lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph, namely for Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, because he was a man of war, therefore he was given Gilead and Bashan. And there was a lot for the rest of the children of Manasseh, according to their families, for the children of Abiezer, the children of Helek, the children of Asriel, the children of Shechem, the children of Hefer, and the children of Shemida. These were the male children of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, according to their families. But Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, but only daughters. And these are the names of his daughters: Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they came near before Eleazar the priest, before Joshua the son of Nun, and before the rulers, saying, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brothers." Therefore, according to the commandment of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among their father's brothers. 10 shares fell to Manasseh, besides the land of Gilead and Bashan, which were on the other side of the Jordan, because the daughters of Manasseh received an inheritance among his sons, and the rest of Manasseh's sons had the land of Gilead. And the territory of Manasseh was from Asher to Mikmethah, that lies east of Shechem, and the border went along south to the inhabitants of En-Tapuah. Manasseh had the land of Tapuah, but Tapuah on the border of Manasseh belonged to the children of Ephraim, and the border descended to the brook Kanath, southward to the brook. These cities of Ephraim are among the cities of Manasseh. The border of Manasseh was on the north side of the brook, and it ended at the sea. Southward it was Ephraim's, northward it was Manasseh's, and the sea was the border. Manasseh's territory was adjoining Asher in the north and Issachar on the east. And in Issachar and Asher, Manasseh had Bethshin and its towns, Iblin and its towns, the inhabitants of Dor and its towns, the inhabitants of Endor and its towns, the inhabitants of Tana and its towns, the inhabitants of Megiddo and its towns, 3 hilly regions. Yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities, but the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it happened, when the children of Israel grew strong, that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. Verse 14, then the children of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given us only one lot and one share to inherit, since we are a great people, inasmuch as the Lord has blessed us until now?" So Joshua answered them, "If you are a great people, then go up to the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you." But the children of Joseph said, "The mountain country is not enough for us. And all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both those who are of Beth Shin and its towns, and those who are of the valley of Jezreel. And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, You are a great people, and have great power. You shall have not have only one lot, but the mountain country shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you shall cut it down, and its furthest extent shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots and are strong. We come to Joshua chapter 16 and chapter 17. Although we are covering two chapters, we discover that chapter 16 especially is not too long. And they are related, they concern the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. And today we come to this message, Pride in Manasseh and Ephraim. We know that the world is under the power of Satan. Satan fell from heaven because of his pride. His pride manifested itself in his desire for power and recognition, and he challenged God and was thrown down to earth. And although he is a powerful enemy of ours, he is no match for our Creator. And God has confined him under chains, as it were, for the moment. He's active, and through his agents, he's doing much harm in this world. The book of Revelation reveals to us three main agents he's constantly using to draw people away and to harass the church. There is the agent of false teaching. Then there is the agent of persecution. Then there is the agent of worldliness. Satan uses these three agents to trouble the church and to draw people away so that they would not hear the gospel, they would not come to faith in Christ. And if possible, Satan would like to drag God's people away so that they perish in their sins. But we know that God will not allow that to happen. So Satan is powerful, but God in this gospel age has bound him so that his power is limited, and the gospel continues to go forth to do his work. Now, what can harm us? Often it is not so much the problem outside that harms us. Yes, it causes distress, but it will not destroy the church. The Lord has promised that the gates of Hades will not prevail against his church. The gospel will continue to go forth and Satan's kingdom will fall. The people whom he's holding captive will be saved. All God's chosen people will be saved as they hear the gospel. So nothing can stop the gospel. But the church is constantly being harassed. God's people are harassed. But what we must fear more is problems from within the church. And one problem that constantly troubled the church is pride. And we know that Satan fell by pride, and pride is a big problem, and pride can easily be stirred up in us by Satan and his agents. Therefore, we must be extremely careful of pride. Pride affects virtually everyone, and pride can affect groups of people. Sections of the church can be affected by pride, and this is what we want to consider today. We see how the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim became proud. And we also want to know how this pride manifested itself. And we also want to see how Joshua wisely contained the pride within these two tribes. So we have seen already thus far that Joshua was commanded by God to supervise the distribution of the land before he died. And Joshua did that, and later in the subsequent chapter, we are going to see how he sent out the surveyors, scouts, to survey the land, and then to come back to give a report so that it could be more clearly and distributed in a fair manner. But here we are given how the account of how the biggest tribe, Judah, had been allocated their inheritance. Then the next big tribe, which would be the next big tribe? Can you name which were the bigger tribes? The tribe of Judah, everyone knows, is the biggest tribe. And in the book of Numbers, which we covered some time recently, in chapter 2 of Numbers, that the size of the tribes are given, and you discover that the next bigger tribe was not Manasseh, it was not Ephraim. Instead, the next bigger tribe were some others, which we will mention in a moment. If you can look at a quick look at Numbers chapter 2, you know that Dan was the next bigger tribe, and Simeon followed after that. So why mention Ephraim and Manasseh? You see, and it is because when combined together, they became the next bigger tribe, next to Judah. And we are going to see how this play up in these two tribes, causing problems, which was wisely contained by Joshua. Otherwise, it would have caused tremendous havoc among the people of God. So what lesson may we learn from today's passage? The lesson we are going to establish is that pride is a cause of discord to the harmony and the unity of God's people. And we want to see how this applies to God's people through the ages, how pride may manifest itself. So let us consider the passage section by section, like what we have mentioned before. First, we consider the reasons for pride. Then secondly, we consider how the pride manifested itself. Then thirdly, we consider how the pride was dealt with. So reasons for pride, manifestation of pride, and dealing with pride. So the first section is reasons for pride. Now Manasseh and Ephraim combined together became the next bigger tribe. But why combined together? And this is where you must see that there are times when they would regard themselves as two tribes. And when it suits their purpose, they will regard themselves as one tribe. And they would play about this game, as it were. And the reason was because Manasseh and Ephraim were the two sons of Joseph. And Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Remember the story? God called Abraham from Samaria to go to Canaan. So Abraham went by faith. Abraham had a son, Isaac. The covenant blessing given by God was going to be passed from Abraham to Isaac, not to Ishmael. Although Ishmael will be blessed with material prosperity, but the covenant blessing was going to be upon Isaac. Then Isaac had a son, Jacob. And Jacob's name was changed to Israel. So when we refer to Jacob or Israel, we are referring to the same man. Now Israel had 12 sons. And one of the sons was Joseph. Joseph was sold away to Egypt. And God, in his providential dealings, caused Joseph to rise up as the prime minister of Egypt. And God mightily used him to save the people of Egypt from severe famine. And the great work of Joseph extended even to Canaan, and his own family members came down to settle in Egypt. And the Hebrew people, the people who were descended from Abraham, they multiplied in Egypt. And after the death of Joseph, a new pharaoh, a new king came to power, a new dynasty was established. And they did not know Joseph and the great contribution he had made to Egypt. So they did not know, and therefore they did not appreciate the Hebrew people. They began to oppress the Hebrews and look upon them as a threat. And as they multiplied, they became more frightened. The Egyptians became more afraid. And so they went through various schemes to try and contain the growth of these people. And with time, the misery of the people was unbearable, and they cried out to God. And God raised them up Moses as their leader to lead them out of Egypt. And Moses led them all the way through the wilderness wandering to the border of Canaan. And when he died, Joshua took over and led the descendants of Israel, the Israelites, into the promised land. So that then is roughly the history and how they connect with Joseph. Joseph was one of the sons of Jacob or Israel. And Joseph was blessed by God, although he suffered much. And often those who suffer much are those who learn to keep a close walk with God, and they are blessed by God. See? And those who don't suffer, they don't know how to value the blessing of God, and therefore the blessing of God, even given to them in abundance, will not be appreciated. It's like giving flowers to the monkey, we say. We have a saying in this country, isn't it? So the monkey wouldn't appreciate the beauty of the flower, he would just tear it to pieces. See? So Joseph was blessed by God, and God made up for the suffering of Joseph by blessing the two sons, counting them as two tribes in Israel. So originally there were 12 sons, but the descendants of Levi was not going to be given an inheritance. They were set aside to serve God in his temple and to serve God by teaching his word in the various Levite cities. Okay? So the tribe of Levi had no physical inheritance like the other tribes. They were only given cities with land sufficient for them to cultivate, that's all. They have to depend on the support of the other 11 tribes. But with Joseph's children being split into two, we have still 12 tribes. So often the 12 tribes are referred to as receiving inheritance, and the tribe of Levi had God only as their inheritance. So with this explanation, we are clearer why it is that 12 tribes became 13, and yet often only 12 tribes are mentioned as receiving an inheritance. The reason is because the tribe of Levi is not counted when it comes to receiving an inheritance. Instead, they were going to be supported by these other 12 tribes. And Joseph's children, therefore, were in some sense prominent because they descended from this man Joseph, who was well loved by God. He suffered much, no doubt, but God used him mightily, and God's people were preserved because God worked through Joseph as their savior. So Joseph at that time was used by God to preserve his people. And Manasseh and Ephraim knew this and took pride in this. And in a sense, that is pride, that is right. You can be proud in the right sense. But they carried it too far and it became wrong. Anything right, good, and true can be carried too far and it becomes wrong. Often it is that in a Christian life, people begin well with holy zeal and wanting to do certain things for God's glory. But along the way, as they serve God, they forget that they are doing God's work. They begin to treat it as their own work. They begin to build up an empire for themselves. And they are so concerned that this work must succeed. And when certain things go wrong, they are so very disappointed and they become frustrated, they become angry. And often it is because they fail to remember that they are serving God and they are doing God's work. They begin to treat the work as their own. So this is a common phenomenon. And with the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, these two tribes, they were behaving something like this. They could rightly be proud of being the descendants of Joseph. They could refer back to the suffering that their forefather Joseph underwent. They could refer to Joseph as the means used by God to preserve his people and to preserve many other people. They could rightly be proud, but they carried it too far and along the way began to throw their weight around. We have this expression, throwing your weight around. That means you want to be recognized. You want to have the position of preeminence. You want people to respect you. You want some recognition, and not only recognition, and even power, influence. You want something for yourself. And this is one way in which pride shows itself. And we are going to consider this in a moment. But for the moment, we see the root of the pride in the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. They began right. They could rightly be proud of being descendants of Joseph. And they should walk humbly before God and before man. For all the blessings we receive from God, we must always walk carefully before God and man. Be thankful and walk carefully. There's no necessity for a godly person to fall. There's no necessity for a blessed person to fall. We can be thankful to God, walk humbly before God and man, and continue to receive His blessing and be a blessing to others. But the problem comes when we forget ourselves and we begin to throw our weight around. And you see this manifesting itself in verse 14 and verse 15. You look at verse 14. We are told there the two tribes are referred to as the children of Joseph. So they acted together. You look at verse 16. And the children of Joseph, they acted together. See? They rightly took pride in the fact that they were descended from Joseph. And they were rightly united as two tribes over against all the others. But when you carry it too far, you begin to treat the other tribes as though they are aliens. You are like different from them in a negative sense. Then that is not right. That is not good. Because God had 12 tribes and plus the tribe of Levi, 13 tribes as His children. So if you count the descendants of Joseph as two tribes, then there are all together 13 tribes. And all of them were the children of God. All of them constitute the people of God. So how could Manasseh and Ephraim begin to behave as though the other tribes were somehow less God's children compared to them? They shouldn't. Their pride was beginning to take hold of them. Then you note that in verse 4, they acted as though they were separate tribes. When it suited them, they would come to demand for more land. They said that, how could you treat us with one lot? Now you give us only one lot. But wait a moment. You see, you have forgotten that half the tribe of Manasseh has already been given a lot in the eastern part. So when it suits you, you say, no, here we are two tribes. Therefore, you must give us two lots. Okay? And when it suited them, they would come together and say, we are the children of Joseph. So they tended to act like that. And that was a form of throwing their weight around. And we must remember that the passage shows to us, first of all, how the two tribes were given land. So in chapter 16, verse 1 to verse 4, we have the overall description. It is like the introduction. Ephraim and Manasseh were given their inheritance after the tribe of Judah. The biggest tribe, Judah, had been given their inheritance. The next bigger tribe was the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh combined together. Rightly speaking, you should have treated them as separate tribes. And when treated as separate tribes, they were actually not the next bigger tribe. Ephraim was way down. You see, we have noted that Dan and Asher were actually bigger tribes than Ephraim. And Manasseh, we always think of Benjamin as the smallest tribe. But actually, Manasseh by itself is smaller than even Benjamin. But since it suited them to consider themselves as together, we are the next bigger tribe, we are the children of Joseph. So when it suited them, they say, we are the children of Joseph. Okay? So combined together, they are the next bigger tribe, next to Judah. So okay, you are the children of Joseph together, so you will be considered next, since together you are the next bigger tribe. And verse 1 to verse 4 therefore give an overall description that the land was distributed to them. And verse 4 ends by saying, so the children of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, took their inheritance. Then the subsequent verses gives a more detailed account. So in verse 5 to the end of the chapter, of chapter 16, we are given an account of the land occupied by Ephraim. Then chapter 17 begins to describe the tribe of Manasseh. But Manasseh, remember, was split into two. There was Manasseh East and there was Manasseh West. Who were Manasseh East? Remember when Moses led the Israelites up along the river Jordan on the eastern side of the river? They conquered Sihon and Og, and then along the way drove away all the subdued enemies there. And the tribe of Reuben and Gad said to Moses, "We are a pasturing people, we have many cattle, and this land is suitable for us. We would like to be settled here. Can you please allow us?" And Moses consulted God, and it was allowed. So Reuben and Gad got their inheritance first. But as Reuben and Gad requested for their inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan, half the tribe of Manasseh joined in and said, "We also have plentiful cattle. We would like to settle this side as well." And that's how 2.5 tribes were settled on the eastern side of the river Jordan. The other half tribe of Manasseh went over to the other side. Yeah? And now land was being distributed to them. But before talking about Manasseh West, we are reminded of Manasseh East. Wait a moment, before we talk about Manasseh West, remember Manasseh East has been settled on the eastern side of the river Jordan. And not only have they been settled, they were settled well in land that they were satisfied with. And that was rightly given to them. They were worthy of it because Manasseh, the eldest son, was a man called Makir. Makir, the son of Manasseh, he was the father of Gilead, and Gilead became well known for his fighting, and he fought the enemies there, and the land became known as Gilead. And after that, Gilead and Bashan, the area became under them. So verse 1 to verse 2 of chapter 17 describe how they were worthy to occupy that, and they were satisfied, they were well settled. But another thing we are reminded of was this. Manasseh, the tribe of Manasseh, somehow seemed to have more daughters than sons. And you know how it is that some families are like that. Much as they like to have just one son, if only we can get one son, but they try so hard, they never got a son. They keep having daughters, a daughter, and daughter after daughter. And don't laugh at them, okay? This is not a laughing matter. Others keep having sons, you know. And of course, if you are in the culture where sons are so much favored, then you are so happy to have so many sons. But for those who look upon sons and daughters as equal, you discover those with just many sons, they would yearn for a daughter. And they look at other people's daughters, you think they are drooling, you know, with yearning for a daughter. So it happens like this. Some families tend to have more sons. Some families tend to have more daughters. And at least for Manasseh East, they seem to have more daughters. And that constituted a problem. And one example was the family of Zelophehad. And we have actually come across this incident in the days when Moses was still alive. Moses was approached by the family of Zelophehad and say, "You know, it's not fair. Now my family is full of daughters. And by our law, our custom so far, daughters are not given inheritance because they are being married out. Then they will share in the inheritance of the husband. But when I die, my inheritance go to who? I go to my brothers and my my nephews and others. You see, so what about my daughters? And what if some of them are not married? So what happens?" So when this matter was brought before Moses, Moses again brought the matter before God, and God said, "It is right that in families where there are no sons, the daughters must be provided for." So the daughters got shares of inheritance like the others. And in verse 3 onwards, chapter 17, verse 3 onwards, we are reminded of this incident. And then in verse 5, we are told, in total, 10 shares fell to Manasseh beside the land of Gilead and Bashan, which were on the other side of the Jordan, because the daughters of Manasseh, so it's not just Zelophehad. Zelophehad was just one family as an example. So the daughters of Manasseh received an inheritance among his sons, and the rest of Manasseh's sons had land of Gilead. So this paints for us the background. Then we are told of the territory of Manasseh west, where it stretched and so on, okay, from north to south, east and west. Okay, so the background is over. So all in all, we see that the tribes should be happily settled. And we should be happy that Manasseh and Ephraim are so close to one another. Even within a family, if you see two siblings close to one another, it's a wonderful sight. We treat all our children equally, but if here two of them seems to get close to one another, two get close to one another there, it's okay, it's within the family, and age differences could be a factor drawing two of them closer together. Then interests, common interests could draw them together, or some other factors like that. And as parents, we look upon our children with contentment, with joy, that they love one another, and if two are closer to one another, apparently more than the others, it's okay, but because they don't quarrel, they don't fight. Okay? So Manasseh and Ephraim, they are so close together, for as long as they don't treat the other tribes as enemies, for as long as they don't withdraw themselves and be selfish, that would have been all right. See? It was is a pleasing sight to see that their inheritance were allocated. And in fact, to be close is our strength. You know what it is like to have a strength of the three strands of a rope being untwined. A rope is strong only because the three strands, assuming that there are three strands, the three strands are twined together. But if you untwine them, you see, each strand becomes less. Or using a Chinese illustration, you know, a bunch of chopsticks is difficult to break, but if you take them separately, it's easy to break. Okay? So a family that is united is definitely strong. And if Israel could remain united, even though Manasseh and Ephraim seems to be sticking together all the time, but nevertheless, it's a strength to the whole nation. And in the Bible, unity among God's people is a thing that is valued. And those who disrupt the unity of the church is actually condemned. And the words used are very strong, you see. And the Lord looks upon those who attempt to break the unity of the church as doing great harm. And the Lord is not pleased. You take one example. In Romans chapter 16, the well-known passage, Romans chapter 16, we are told of those who cause division by their wrong teaching. Wrong teaching is not only wrong compared to what is right from God, but it has the effect of dividing the church. And God looks upon the unity of the church as something very precious, very sacred. And in verse 17 of Romans 16, it says, "Now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses, contrary to the doctrine which you learn, and avoid them." See? And then, of course, there's the well-known passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, chapter 14. Uh-huh. Chapter 12 in particular. We are all baptized in the same spirit, in the body of Christ. There is this one body with many members. Many members, one body. And the discussion of how that unity can be broken by pride, by pride in the members, is well described in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. But all in all, we want to see the root of pride in Manasseh and Ephraim. It was because of their descent from Joseph, the prominent son of Jacob. They could have been rightly proud, but along the way, they began to throw their weight around. When they like it, they consider themselves as two tribes. When they did not like it, when they stood their advantage in another way, they would consider themselves as one tribe. And along the way, the two seems to be sticking together within the whole people of God. And it would have been pleasing, it would have been all right. But for pride, pride begins to turn ugly. Right? So pride in the wrong sense began to exert itself. Now we see how it manifested itself. Firstly, in covetousness, and second, in complacency. And covetousness is the desire to have more, to want more. And you look at others' property, you want more. See, you want what they have. So the covetous heart, the heart of wanting more and more for yourself. See, and normally it is not to God's glory. It is more for yourself. You want to squander it upon yourself. And you're comparing yourself with others and you want to outdo them. So covetousness is condemned as a sin in the Ten Commandments. So work through the Ten Commandments. You know that the first four concerns our relationship with God. The last six concerns our relationship one with another, the relationship between man. Okay? And of course, if you can memorize the first four commandments, how we are to worship one God and the attitude and the manner and finally the day, then you can memorize the six commandments regarding our relationship with one another by looking at the obvious sins that are acted out. See? So, of course, with verse commandment number five being in between, honor your father and mother, but then the serious sins begin. So, do not murder, and so on, down the line. Up to the last one. The last one is most serious from the point of the inner self, okay? The inner desire. Okay? So in that way, you can learn to memorize the Ten Commandments, and I deliberately want you to work that out. Curiosity will cause you later to kind of check that out and say, you know, which is the next commandment, what is the next one, and in that way you will learn. But the point that we want to establish now is this. In the Ten Commandments, covetousness is condemned. It shows to us that God wants us to recognize it is a manifestation of pride. It causes so much damage. When your heart is not content with what you have, you begin to want to have more for yourself. You look at what others have, you become dissatisfied with your own, what you have, and then you want more. So that attitude spills over in so many areas. People are covetous over what? Over power, over money, over influence. For influence often is related to power, of course, but it's also related to money. And there are those who want influence over people, over property, see? And women, and pleasure, see? And of course, women, we can mention men. Some women want men, and don't think that women are so innocent victims all the time. Yeah, there are women being, they are humans as well, and there are desires in their hearts, and there are women who want men, see, seek up men. Okay? But you know what I mean, see. So along the way, covetousness shows itself in so many ways. We covet this, covet that. We are not satisfied, see. We are one degree after another, we are not satisfied. We're forever students. Yeah? And we accumulate property, one car after another. It's just my hobby. But is it just your hobby? Yeah? Then you accumulate property, houses. Yeah? Just my hobby. But you buy, sell, wow, making money. Wow. Well, that can be a legitimate way of making a living. But it can also be lead you astray. So in anything right and legitimate, you can go overboard, you can go astray. So here is the warning to us. And here we are reminded of how these people took pride in the fact that they descended from Joseph, and when it suited them, they would want to assert their right as the favored descendants of Joseph. And here we see in verse 14, the children of Joseph spoke to Joshua, "Why have you given us only one lord, one share to inherit, since we are a great people? What do they mean by a great people? As noted already, they were the next bigger tribe. They were next to Joshua in terms of size, in terms of numbers. But that is only when they are combined. When they are separated, Ephraim is somewhere in the middle. Manasseh was even smaller than the tribe of Benjamin. See? So, okay, you want to combine together, you regard yourself as the children of Joseph. You combine together, you are the next bigger tribe. But they are meaning more. We are a great people. You must understand who we are. Do you know who we are? You know how some people talk. You don't know me? You don't know who I am? See, from the way they talk, you know that they have position, they have power, they have something to parade. It's as though up their sleeve there is a trump card. You know, when they are on the losing end, they'll take up this card and try to win over you. So they warn you. See, you don't know me? See, you don't know who I am? See, so these people are basically saying, don't forget who we are. We are the descendants of Joseph, the favored son of Jacob, the one favored by God. We are descended from Joseph. Okay? And the Lord has blessed us. Okay? So no doubt the Lord has blessed them because God had promised to bless Joseph and his children. And so his children were blessed. So they have multiplied and together they were indeed the next bigger tribe when combined together. Okay? But why say that we are given only one lot and one share? Have you not forgotten that half the tribe of Manasseh has been given a lot? Look at chapter 17, verse 1. There was also a lot for the tribe of Manasseh with the firstborn Machir in the eastern side. So you conveniently forget that. See, they are also your brethren. They are also part of the tribe of Manasseh. And therefore they are also the children of Joseph. And remember that because they have so many daughters and they specially requested for a share as well. And in verse 5 of chapter 17, we are told they have 10 shares in addition to what had been given earlier. Wow, these people, they're not satisfied and they wanted more. And when it suited them, they want to argue that, you know, we are a big tribe and we are two tribes. Actually, you must not give us just one lot. See? And that sort of argument, how do you win? See? How would Joshua deal with them? So you see this spirit manifesting itself in later days. After the death of Joshua, the nation of Israel plunged into chaos almost, and God had to raise up judges to deliver them, to guide them for periods of time. And the book of Judges show how the nation of Israel sinned against God, and then they suffered, and they cried out to God. God raised up a judge to deliver them. That cycle kept repeating itself, and Israel never seemed to learn. And one of the early judges of Israel was a famous man called Gideon. Gideon was used by God to fight off the Midianites. If you turn to the next book, which is Judges, you look at chapter 8. Okay. Now what happened is, starting from the story begins in chapter 6 actually. So what happened is that the Midianites came in such a great horde, and together with other people they came and destroyed and created so much problems. You see? Then God raised up Gideon for Israel to be the judge, to lead them in battle. And Gideon was a diffident man and didn't dare to assume that he was hearing right from God. So he tested God. He asked God for a test, to prove, a sign, to prove that God really wanted him to lead the nation of Israel. So there was the test of asking for the wool, the sheep wool there to be wet while the ground is dry. Then to reverse it, the ground to be wet and then the wool to be dry. And on both occasions, the signs were as Gideon asked. And Gideon was convinced that God wanted to lead him. Then in chapter 7, we are told that Gideon led all those Israelites together and wanted to go for battle, but there were too many, so God trimmed them down to just 300 men. God wanted to show the people of Israel that it is not by numbers and it's not by clever battle strategy that they won over the enemies, but it was God who has given them the victory. See? So with just 300 men, Gideon won over the battle. And the enemies were scattered everywhere. They ran everywhere. And all the while, the big tribe up in the mountains, the tribe of Ephraim, you see, was not involved. You see. And all the while, people treat them with deference. They were quite a sensitive tribe. So Gideon just used all these other tribes. Since God didn't want everyone, so why engage this? Our brethren, yes, they are our brethren, this big tribe. But when the enemies began to scatter into the territory of Ephraim, Gideon, of course, has to quickly send a message. The enemies are running your way. Please look out for them. Stop them. Get them. See? And in chapter 7, verse 24, Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim saying, come down against the Midianites and seize them from the watering places. See? And that was what happened in verse 25. They captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed in the winepress of Zeb. They pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. We thought, happy ending. So victory over the enemies who were invading. But there was no happy ending. It almost resulted in the nation of Israel fighting one another. And in chapter 8, verse 1, the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. Gideon was a judge, and here the Ephraimites there to reprimand him in public and reprimand him so sharply. You see, and Gideon held his peace, but he answered very wisely. He said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. These people, the Ephraimites, who do they think they were? It has gotten into their heads. They were becoming too proud. They thought they have to be treated special all the time. And just because they were not involved in the initial attack against the Midianites, they were offended. Why didn't you involve us in the first place? You see? But Gideon has to send home all the other tribes because God wanted only 300 men. So why involve the Ephraimites? And when the battle was hot and the people were running in the direction of Ephraim, he did involve them. As the need arose, Gideon acted. That's why Gideon sent a clear message. Enemies are heading your way. Block them. See? And they did that. And when they confronted Gideon, why didn't you involve us? You just go ahead and fight the battle. See? And Gideon answered very wisely. He used a proverb within their circle, which was well known because they were an agricultural community. So the gleanings. So after you harvest, then you leave the gleanings. Gleanings are normally left for poor people. So you don't collect everything. You don't sapu clean your field. You leave some for the poor people to collect along the way. That was a law for Israel. So gleanings, what are gleanings? You have already have the main harvest in, sack after sack of your harvest. So gleanings, small matter. You see, let the poor pick them up. You see? So Gideon is saying, even your gleanings are more valuable than our full harvest. You see, in that you have managed to, you have the honor of catching the two princes of the enemies and slaughter them. You see, so what success are we? Our honor is so minimal compared to the honor that you have of killing the leaders of the Midianites, and that appeased them. You see, they went back. These are the Ephraimites. You know now the sort of character they are. They got themselves too big in their heads. So, back to this Joshua chapter 17, you come to see that their pride manifested itself on this occasion in covetousness. They want more. They wanted more. Okay? And then another way pride manifested itself was in complacency. To be complacent is to be too relaxed and too slothful. They failed to drive out the Canaanites as required by God. See? Judah did not do that as well. Judah, the big tribe. If you look at chapter 15, look at the end of chapter 15, we are told, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. Judah failed. The Jebusites put a fierce fight. And Judah decided, these are too tough for people. But actually, God has promised them victory if only they would exert themselves. But he decided it's too much trouble. That's basically the problem. This is too much trouble. Therefore, they didn't want to do the work of driving out the remaining of the enemies. And now we are dealing with the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And you see that they have the same or similar type of attitude. Look at chapter 16, the last verse. And they did not drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gaza, but the Canaanites dwelt among the Ephraimites to this day and have become forced laborers. You say, not too bad. After all, they were subdued and they become forced laborers. That is only second best. Okay? God's command was to drive them out. See? Unlike the Gibeonites who by deceit made a covenant with Joshua, then you are bound to your words. You see? But in this case, it was out of complacency. They were not prepared to fight it out and finish off the work. They have gone so far, we would say 80% of the work has been done, and perhaps 90% of the work has been done. But what of the 10% left? Only 10% is okay. They wouldn't be able to overwhelm us. Let them be. It's too much trouble. So you think second best is still not too bad. See? And what about Manasseh West? Manasseh East we don't talk about because they have been settled. Okay? In chapter 17, look at verse 12. Yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities. But the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. See? And verse 13 is so revealing. It says, and it happened when the children of Israel grew strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not utterly drive them out. I say this verse is very revealing. Because it speaks of all Israel. It applied to Judah, whom we have read about, who did not drive out the remaining of the Canaanites. It applies to Manasseh and it applies to Ephraim. They did not manage to drive the Israelites out. They opted for second best, make them forced laborers. But were they able to make them forced laborers at the beginning? No. It was much later when Israel began to consolidate and became strong, and then they make them forced laborers. Which means that at the beginning, initially, it was not because they were able to subdue them and make them forced laborers. They just didn't want the trouble of fighting. They want the easy way out. The enemies were actually ruling their own territory, surrounded by the Israelites, you see. So we come to realize it's complacency. See, you take for granted the success. You have come 80%, 90% of the way. God has given you the victory. But what of the remaining territory? Why didn't you complete it? Why? See, it's because we don't want too much trouble. After all, we are the majority. After all, they are confined to their territory. So we will make sure they don't come out of their territory. So it's okay. Safest fighting. Now that attitude of complacency, sloth, taking things for granted, see, not fulfilling the command of God. God's command was to completely drive them out. And if they did not, God warned them. Two things was going to happen. You turn back with me to Numbers chapter 33. Numbers chapter 33. You remember the days of Moses, Numbers 33. The warning has been given to them. And in Numbers 33, in verse 55 onwards, we are told, "But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let to remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you in the land where you dwell. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them." So God is giving them warning. If you don't thoroughly drive them out, they will trouble you. You are constantly going to be harassed. Trouble, 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 trouble. No end to it. See, God was thinking of their good, but they failed to see it that way. They failed to believe God. Then secondly, along the way, like it or not, you are going to be influenced by them for bad. You think you are the majority, you are more powerful, you can influence them. But you interact too closely in peace with them, you will be influenced in some way. And when you are influenced to their idolatry, God is going to judge them the way God intended to judge them. Remember, the Canaanites were judged in the first place because of idolatry. Gross idolatry that has gone on for generations since the days of Abraham. See? So now, we see the seriousness of the situation. So all in all, you take pride in your numbers. We are a big tribe, but only when combined together. Okay? And you take pride in your pedigree. Ha! We are descended from the famous Joseph. Now, you can be rightly proud, as we have mentioned earlier, but don't allow it to grow, turn ugly. The ugly type of pride, the sinful type of pride, you must be very careful. And what is pride if there is no obedience to God's will? What is it? See? And in this case, these big tribes of Judah and of Ephraim and Manasseh, these big tribes were setting a bad example for the other tribes in not asserting themselves, not obeying God, not driving out the Canaanites. See? And we must always remember, our action does have effects upon others, for good and for bad. And as believers, our life has been transformed, our thinking has been changed. And we would think of God's glory. Then we would think of the edification of the church. We don't think, oh, me first, me, 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 I first, I, me. See, the I and the me type mentality is that of an unconverted person. See? And often the unconverted part of us still remains to trouble us. And even though you have professed faith, you are baptized, you are a member of the church, you have been a Christian serving God, but along the way, the me, I, tends to be there, and you have to be careful. Right? Things cling on. See? So it is as we grow in spiritual maturity, see, we come to see that this are less and less sin. We will not be perfect in this world, but nevertheless, part of spiritual maturity is to think of God's glory and the good of the church first, not your personal convenience and not what you can gain. No. So these then are two ways in which this tribe manifested their pride, their wrongful pride, pride carried astray, covetousness and complacency. And we see next, the last section, how Joshua dealt with the pride in these combined tribes. Joshua was approached by them, and they probably thought Joshua is one of us. Do you know that? In Numbers chapter 13, verse 6 and verse 7, when Caleb and Joshua are mentioned, Numbers 13 was when the 12 spies were sent to spy out Canaan in the days of Moses. Caleb and Joshua were the two spies who gave a positive report. And Caleb, we know, was from the tribe of Judah, the biggest tribe. And we have come across him and his family in the earlier chapter. But now, we consider Joshua. Joshua was actually from the tribe of Ephraim. Ah, now you see the connection. So Ephraim and Manasseh came thinking that Joshua will favor them. They could just demand because he's one of us. One of us. But Joshua was not going to entertain that sort of approach, that sort of attitude. The reason is because first and foremost, Joshua was a servant of God, and he must be faithful to his God. Then secondly, Joshua was a leader of God's people, and God's people is made up of those 13 tribes, not just the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. And Joshua kept that clear. And therefore, how should he handle these people? He handled them very wisely and very firmly. See, okay, you in that case, you have not enough land. Go and clear the mountains. The mountains are occupied by the Perizzites. Go, clear the mountains. And the valleys there, the valleys are still occupied by the Canaanites. Go and subdue them. Okay. And what was the response of Ephraim and Manasseh, the children of Joseph? Again, they combine together, they talk together. You see, for their own good, they would stand united. They say, you know, even if we clear the mountains, it's not enough for us. See, the mountains are not enough for us. But you haven't even cleared yet, you see, and you say that it's not enough. And then the Canaanites in the valleys, they are too powerful for us. They have chariots of iron. And we have nothing. How can you expect us to fight against them? And understand, chariots of iron in those days are the equivalent of tanks for today. So in a battle, if you have tanks, wow, you're powerful. And combined with fighter jets in the air, combined with warships, or even submarines shooting torpedoes, you are so powerful, invincible. See, but you see, in those days, chariots with wheels of iron, they have sharp spikes sticking out, and as they drove the chariots, the people in the chariots shoot arrows, and they come near, they slaughter people with their spear and their sword. And meanwhile, as the driver of the chariot, they drive the horse through the enemies. The wheels go past all these people, and as the wheels roll, the sharp spikes go past these people and sweep and cut their legs, cut their horses down. So it's such a powerful machine, fighting machine. So the Ephraim and Manasseh say, we can't fight them because they have chariots of iron. Okay. And what did Joshua do? Often it is when people are more persuasive, then you back down. See? But when you are dealing with God's work, you must think, you see, what does God's word say? See? What is the right thing to do? And in this case, Joshua was clear-minded and he remained firm. And he's firm, very firm, but in such a way that you know that he's not rough. See? He acknowledged in verse 17, to Ephraim and Manasseh, you are a great people. You have great power. You shall not have one Lord. That's true. See? Therefore, go! Clear the mountains. See? And go! Fight the Canaanites in the valley. See? Basically saying to them, if you have the will, you will have the way. You will be able to overcome all these enemies. God, after all, has promised you victory. And with the Lord on your side, you will be able to have the victory. So Joshua was firm. If Joshua had not been firm, what could have happened? You can imagine what could have happened. The other tribes would be so discontented. Then they will blame Joshua, saying, you are also an Ephraimite. You support your own brethren. And things like that would have happened. See? So it's good to be firm in a situation like this, but firm by being firm on principles, on being what is true. And the Ephraimites at this time appeared to have accepted that. They knew that Joshua was not going to budge. And they came to realize, even if grudgingly, you want God's blessing? God's blessing is achieved by hard work. See? You cannot run away from the fact that God blesses his people, but he wants his people to work hard. See? And this is the constant teaching of the Bible. You can't run away from it. We believe in the sovereignty of God. But we believe that God in his sovereignty wants to use us in going out. Go into the world and make disciples of all the nations. So you have to go. You have to make the effort. The Apostle Paul labored. And as he labored, he knew that God was at work in him as he worked.
Manasseh.
We must be saved by grace through faith in Christ alone. There is simply no other way God has arranged for anyone to be saved. It is by grace, that means freely given, not earned. It is through faith in Christ alone. And yet we are told to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. See, along the way we have to exert effort to obey God's law, to do what is right. Okay? And we recognize that God is at work in us. Now we have covered three sections: reasons for pride, manifestation of pride, dealing with pride. Pride is a big problem. It is always there. It is like a virus that can never be eliminated from the earth. It's lurking there. And given the slightest chance, it will manifest itself. And two ways it has manifested in the passage we have studied. First, covetousness. Second, complacency. So first we ask the question, has covetousness been troubling anyone of God's children here? Have you been not satisfied with what you have and you keep wanting more and more and more? You look at others, also you want. You look at the shops displaying anything, you also want. You're not satisfied. And it may be position, it may be power, it may be degree, it may be influence, it may be money, it may be property, and it may be cars or houses. But it can also be your clothes and your shoes and your purse, your next handbag, or your computer, your handphone. Have you got what number is it? Six now, is it what? See, so have you got it? Now your heart is just not satisfied. You want more, you want more, you want the latest. Others have it, you also want it. You see it displayed, you also want it. That heart, be very careful. And then when it comes into the church, how does it display itself? I want to be recognized. I want at least to have something to do. Hey, well, there's so much to do. What do you mean? You know, something more prominent, more useful, based on my gift. You have gifts, right? Of course you have. But by the way you talk, we know. You just want preeminence. So you must be careful. And when you don't get what you want, you are unhappy, not realizing that if you really have the necessary gifts, it will be recognized. See, the church wouldn't be so foolish as not to recognize and use your gifts. And in fact, the church will be chastised and be on the losing end, will lose the blessing if it doesn't recognize the gifts that God has given to the members. Okay? So we must understand the danger here, covetousness. Then complacency. Which one of us have been affected by complacency? You have gone so far, you have accomplished so much, but why leave things undone? It's just a little bit more. You say, I've done so much already. Leave it for next time, later, when my mood is right, or others, let others do it. See, whatever excuse you give, you must understand that if your conscience is not clear in this matter, God is speaking to you. Is God speaking to you today? See? Those who study, for example, you have done so well so far. You have only a short stretch of distance. Why don't you go full steam all the way and finish the race well? Why? See? So let us look to God and do well. And when applied to gospel work, we have done so much. We are a small church. God has blessed us with opportunities. But let us not rest complacent. There's more territory to occupy. In other words, there are more places to preach the gospel, more people to reach out to. Do we not believe in that? You think everyone has been evangelized here in our vicinity? You think 90% of the people have been evangelized? It's the reverse. You put all the efforts of all the churches together, only about 10% of the people around us have been evangelized. And once you recognize that, you're convinced of that, you can see the sense of burden comes to us. The needs are still very great. We can't accomplish it all, but the burden will help us to place ourselves before God and say, God, here am I. Use me. Send me. Send me. See? Send me. Use me. See? In what way can we be of contribution to the further extension of God's kingdom until God takes us away? Yes, we want to serve until God takes us away. That was a lesson we have learned already. We don't want to hang up our weapons yet. No, not yet. There's more work for us to do. It might not be of the same nature, of the same kind category, but it's basically the same battle. There's still work to do for the Lord. Let us not grow weary in well-doing. We must press on. And if we recognize the fact that we are one in Christ, all of us are members of the body. All of us have been given gifts. How can we contribute to the building up of the Church of Jesus Christ? And my challenge to you is also to place yourself in a situation where you can best be used. See, you don't want to go to a church where the doctrine really upsets you. Then you want to serve in such a church, helping to build up a church which is propagating doctrine that upsets you. See, and of course, at the other end of the spectrum are those who expect perfection. It's because I can't find any good church anywhere. That's why I never commit myself to any. See, and you will never find a good church good enough for you anywhere if you have that sort of attitude. See, if you have found a church that is sincerely trying to be faithful to God, why don't you throw in your lot and let us grow all together? Let us die one by one together in the same church. Let us serve the Lord. Because here is a group of people who really sincerely want to be useful in God's service. So may God really help us in this area, that we will consider our Christian life, our walk with God. Let us reaffirm our commitment to our Lord. Lord, you have saved me. Lord, you have been gracious to me. And here I am. Send me. May God have all the glory.